The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print and hair. Hello, this is Martha Potter from the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next half hour, I'll be reading to you from Our State magazine. Today's reading of Our State magazine, is underwritten by Carter Glass Insurance Agency, serving the community since 1974 and underwriting this podcast for over 15 years. They can be reached at 919-781-1973. In this episode, we'll dig deeper into the September issue of Our State magazine, featuring articles around this month's theme, which is The Sounds of Home. And our first article is entitled Night Music. Nighttime fishing excursions attune the ears to the unseen creatures that make up nature's chorus, each singing its own song in the dark. We carried two fishing rods apiece and had a pocket full of hooks, lead split shot we smashed with our teeth, and a tube of 100% DEET dope so strong that the smell burned the inside of our nostrils. We traveled light because we weren't supposed to be there in the first place. Stretched out on the far end of the docks at Oak Hollow Lake and High Point, beyond the illumination of the security lights, we looped the fishing lines around our big toes and laid the rods beside us. That way, when we knotted off, any catfish that took a liking to our globs of worms would tug on the line, which would tug on our toes and wake us up for the fish fight. We thought that was pretty smart. Since we knew it was against the rules to be on the docks after dark, smart wasn't exactly what we were shooting for. But the loop around the toe, that was brilliant. Except I never knotted off. Not once. Lying there in the cooling evening with the warmth from the sun seeping into my back from the dock's wooden boards, you would think I would zonk out in an instant. Instead, I lay there, wide awake, mesmerized by the vespertine chorus. Night sounds flooded in from every direction. The jug-a-room groan of a bullfrog, cricket frogs like glass marbles clicking against each other. There had to be a million of them. The incessant song of a whippoorwill played from a grassy lawn on the far side of the dark parking lot. A curious splash against the shore. Hard to say if it was a feeding bass or a night heron on the hunt. The longer I lay there, the more I heard. I've been an aficionado of night sounds ever since, especially those accompanying a night fishing trip, which is a front row seat to planet Earth's finest symphony. The truth is, we humans are interlopers in the night. We require a solid dose of light for vision, while many animals, if not most, do not. As the earth spins, darkness creeps across the land like a dark fog. A page is turning and many creatures stir. They have adapted and evolved to gather, hoard, and utilize the merest fragments of light, the moon's glow and the star's dim sparkle. The eyes of some bees may even contain photoreceptors that gather light for more extended periods of time than a mere glance, like a camera whose shutter stays open for nighttime exposures. Other creatures sport a separate reflective layer behind the retina called the tapetum lucidum that intercepts any light that escapes the retina and sends it back to the front of the eye for another pass. This is so-called eye shine that glows in your headlights when you see a deer or a cat at night. All those adaptations make nighttime the right time for many creatures to roam. And since we light-adapted humans are literally in the dark, we turn our ears to help fill in the story of the nighttime wilds. Lying on the fishing dock, I would hold perfectly still and perfectly minimize any sound. My breathing, the rasp of my shirt sleeve when I scratched my nose, the rustle of fishing weights, and now and later candies in my pocket. Hearing is what happens when your eardrums vibrate. Listening is an active state, no less than knocking out a push-up. Just as you can boost your night vision by avoiding light, which temporarily destroys the visual purple proteins in your eye that convert light to electric pulses, I think you can boost your hearing by going stone cold quiet. I try to listen past the easy sounds, the shriek of a fowler's toad, the banjo string ploink of a green frog. I pick up the clicky chorus of a field cricket. It must be hunkered down in a hideout somewhere between the dock boards. It's a pleasing sound when you're sprawled out under the stars. Not so much when you're trying to find the raucous rascal that's keeping you awake. Listen. Harder. There's the low baritone hoo-hoo-hoo of a great horned owl, a mournful call that seems a bit out of character for such a creature. If I were a great horned owl, I'd be rocking a 1980s hair metal band song more in keeping with my predatory instincts. I pick up the buzzy, nearly nonstop trill of a Carolina ground cricket and the nagging whine of mosquitoes zeroing in on my earlobes. I didn't say every sound was pleasant. And there's that whippoorwill again. What a chatterbox. A deep breath and let it out. Listen. And that's when I hear the most marvelous sound of the nighttime chorus. It's like a tiny ripple in the night, a quirky, chirpy, chippy call. A southern flying squirrel has come out to play. Most folks wouldn't believe how many of these little critters live around us, for they rarely come out in the daytime. But there it is, when you listen intently, a sound like a dog working over a squeaky toy, just on the edge of hearing. I cock my head to glean each detail and decipher each call. Sound is a river, and all those trills, chirps, grunts, and garumphs blend together in a braided aural stream, flowing out of the humid southern night, ferrying me into a world I cannot see. Our next article is entitled Echoes in the Pines. In the hush of the Piedmont woods, a red-tailed hawk screams out, and one listener follows the call of birds, memory, and family through time. Longleaf pines wake me most mornings in this little corner of the Piedmont. Up in one of those trees lives a red-tailed hawk who has been with me for 3 years, and if the hiss and creak of the trees in the morning breeze don't wake me up, she will. She screams from her perch, and she screams when she wings it past my window. I never fail to get out of bed when I hear her. Perhaps it's because I'm superstitious or maybe a romantic. And maybe it's just the early morning knowledge that the world is thrumming outside and I'll miss it if I don't get going. Why so loud, girl? Time is passing, I imagine her saying, and she's right. It's time. I've missed a lot. I don't want to miss any more. I sit down at my work table. I hear her return to her nest, and together, at least I think of it as together, we get to our work. I first encountered a red-tailed hawk as a silhouette in a beat-up copy of Peterson's A Field Guide to the Birds, 1947 edition, which my parents kept close to settle their disputes. They had met at a biological field station, and throughout their marriage, they argued sharply over the identification and Latin names of birds, wildflowers, insects, and mushrooms in a way that was both combative and fond. I think it was the way they talked to each other that first summer when they fell in love. My sister and I, neither of us ever to become a scientist, were generally able to grasp what they were arguing over. Pattern and shape recognition, color awareness, behavior, environment, the way the world felt when you reached out and touched it. But with birds, they added sound and language, which made my parents seem magical. The crowd of birds that surrounded us in our cabin in the woods sounded just like that to me. A crowd, undifferentiated, impossible to distinguish one from the other. Just a lot of hubbub. And this, together with the sounds of insects and frogs, and the scuffle of critters in the underbrush, and even the rattlesnake that seemed to hiss rather than rattle, was the sound of the woods. On our hikes up the little mountain, my father would say, "There's a Carolina wren. You know that one." But I didn't, and I'd say, "Where?" And he'd say, "He didn't know, but it's out there. Don't you hear it?" The birds my parents knew were everywhere. "There's a cardinal," Dad would say. "They're easy to hear." And, "Shh, stop. There's a pine warbler." But all I heard was the cacophony, the insistent sound of the unknown, secretive, omnipresent, and unfathomable fecund woods. Sometimes I turned back to the cabin to get some quiet. I now know that there is no quiet place. And if there were such a place, I wouldn't want to live there. And even more, learning the sounds of what's out there in the piney woods was worth the effort. There's comfort in knowing each of the voices in the choir. Crowd noise, undifferentiated, becomes white noise, a desert containing nothing, a barrier to memory. But one blue jay scrabbling under the blackberries and calling out its warnings is a connection, and then a memory. There was my father at Merritt's store when he was at UNC, the bell of the gas station dinging, asking if he could trap varmints on Mr. Merritt's land for a population study. And even before that, there was the sound of waves in the bay where Dad fell in love with biology. One leads to the next. Even the sound of my parents debating the sound of the birds is itself a memory, or really a thousand of them. It's quieter now, but not quiet. My mother is no longer here to argue with my father, so on the bird-watching trip my sister, father, and I took to the coast, it was my sister and I who argued with him. We're pretty good birders, my sister and I, but we also use our phones to help us. Dad has his books. "Dad, I think that's an anhinja," I said, pointing at the strange, big, dark water bird with the improbable neck, sunning its wing. "Yeah, I don't know about that. Dad, here's a picture. No, wait, here's a video," I say, holding up the screen to him. He squints at it. "It could be, but I'll need my books." I look at my sister, and she shakes her head. There's only one person whose opinion he might have accepted on the spot, and only after a colorful argument. But she wasn't with us, and it's no fun to argue with a phone. I understood that. When we got back and he confirmed the identification in one of his many bird books, it didn't feel like much of a victory to me. It felt like cheating. But there is a kind of cheating Dad has embraced, and that's the app on his phone that identifies bird calls. Sometimes on a bird walk, he'll fall behind, and on backtracking, we'll find this man in his 80s, more bent and craggy than he used to be, standing perfectly still and holding his phone high above his head like a torch. He looks up at the tree canopy expectantly, as if this device could draw all the bird song in the world to him, where he could keep it forever. He can still identify dozens and dozens of birds. He's still got the knack, and those calls also cross across the decades to find him. I stand quietly next to him with my own phone raised in the air. He and I look down at the list on our phones. Dozens of bird species surround us, close enough to be heard by our little microphones, and in the trees, only an occasional shadow zips through our peripheral vision. A flash of color so fast you wonder if you actually saw it. In our list is evidence that we are surrounded not just by sounds we know, but also by the unseen Carolina chickadees, the yellow-rumped warblers, the gnatcatchers and the flycatchers, the vireos and the phoebes. A secret world of things yet to be seen and sounds to be remembered. These days, I want to remember the sound of everything. "We're never alone, I guess," I say to my dad. "You have no idea," he tells me. I live by myself now at the moment. There's a chipping sparrow outside my window. I see nothing, but I hear it. I've been learning. There's a Carolina wren out there, too, and there's always a cardinal. Can't see those either. Then they all go quiet. My hawk has returned, and she's got a lot on her mind. Her call echoes. I work on learning my bird calls, and I have great friends who walk the Haw River and listen with me. Slowly, the words have become knowable, and the critters known, not exactly companions, but not strangers either. My little corner of the Piedmont expands and contracts simultaneously. My daughters are adults now, and their little bare feet no longer thump down the hallway of our old house. I hear the sound of air and the feathers of the eagle that nests across the river. My father lives in Kentucky near my sister, and we had to skip the birding trip this year because Dad just wasn't up to it. Every so often I hear a new bird, and the world becomes bigger. I'm becoming balder. Things change. And then there's the twittering from the table. "Hi, Dad," I hear my daughter say on the speaker, and it all connects in that instant. The sound of everything I cared about comes back to me. Our next article is entitled "Well Said." Led by a professor who sees himself as an accidental linguist, quote-unquote, a nonprofit program at NC State celebrates dialect diversity and shows that the way we speak is something to be embraced. At Wolf Wolfram's booth at the State Fair, posters surrounding him describe the various dialects of North Carolina. In front of his table, fairgoers listen to recordings of dialects and guess where in the state they originated. They spin a wheel with photos of different objects to see if they can name them in their own dialect. They grab buttons with fun terms or phrases that represent the diverse ways people speak across the state. Fixin' To, Bless Your Heart, and All Y'all are popular choices, but Lumbee's visiting his booth become more excited than anyone when they see the button that says Fine in the World, a popular phrase among members of their community. Wolfram likes to explain to people who stop by the booth inside the Governor Carr Scott building that, contrary to what they may have learned in school, there is no right or wrong way to talk. Sure, language can be grammatical or ungrammatical. It can adhere to dictionary definitions or be chock full of slang. But if you can talk and people can comprehend you, it's right, Wolfram says, which is not to say socially people consider it right. Wolfram is a linguist and the director of the Language and Life Project at North Carolina State University. His nonprofit program seeks to celebrate dialect diversity and spread the message that, as Wolfram says, dialects are something to be treasured as opposed to something to be ashamed of. That shame is a result of dialect prejudice. Often when people who aren't from the South hear a strong Southern accent, they assume that the speaker is backward, uneducated, and unsophisticated. Many times that language prejudice is tied to racial prejudice. Traditional Black North Carolina dialects are distinctive, as are Lumbee, Hispanic, and other ethnic dialects. If people comment on Black speech, it's really a comment about Black people, Wolfram says. But more than other kinds of discrimination, linguistic discrimination is tolerated, and Wolfram wants to change that. Wolfram grew up in Philadelphia, the youngest of six children born to German immigrants. The family lived in a predominantly German neighborhood, attended a German-speaking church, and spoke German at home. But Wolfram was born during World War II and attended a school that had a high concentration of Jewish students. As a young boy, his non-German neighbors would play army and pretend to kill Germans. Wolfram began to feel conflicted and developed an aversion to his native tongue. In high school, Wolfram asked a Jewish girl to the prom. She initially said yes, but the next day at school, she informed him that her parents wouldn't let her go with him because of his heritage. That was humiliating, Wolfram says. On prom night, he stayed home. Wolfram wanted to hide his German roots and establish his identity as an American. As a child, he began to pay attention to the dialect spoken around him and he learned to talk like a Pennsylvanian. He didn't go to the beach. He went to the shore. At the shore, he played in the water. He didn't have a bad day. He had a bad day. Wolfram never really traveled anywhere until he attended Wheaton College in Illinois. Before he got there, he assumed that his way of speaking was normal and standard. At Wheaton, Wolfram played football and studied cultural anthropology with a minor in Greek, and the lessons he learned about language when he was growing up, that it is inextricably tied to culture and is a cornerstone of a person's identity, were reinforced through his studies. After earning a master's and a PhD in linguistics from Hartford Seminary Foundation in Connecticut, Wolfram planned to serve as a missionary and translate the Bible for an indigenous tribe in South America. When he couldn't raise enough money to accomplish that, his mentor offered him a job doing linguistics research and teaching the subject at Georgetown University. So I consider myself an accidental linguist, he says. Wolfram went on to teach at the University in the District of Columbia. More than two decades later, on Thanksgiving Eve, he was offered a distinguished professorship at NC State. I thought it was a gag call, to tell you the truth, because who calls you the night before Thanksgiving, Wolfram says with a laugh. So we came here on a lark. Wolfram has been the William C. Friday Distinguished University Professor at NC State since 1992. In 1993, he started the North Carolina Language and Life Project to study and document the dialects of the state and the country. Before then, much of the linguistic diversity of the state had never been researched. Through his work, he has studied the vernacular of North Carolina from Appalachia to the Outer Banks, generation to generation, urban versus rural. He also developed museum exhibits in Ocracoke, Manteo, and Robeson County on very local dialects, created a curriculum to teach eighth graders about language diversity, and produced 15 documentary films on the subject for public television. Wolfram is fond of saying, North Carolina is dialect heaven. We have as many dialects as any state in the country, he explains. There isn't a state that has a richer heritage. He has identified five main dialect regions in the state: the Southern Appalachian Highlands, the Coastal Plain, Pamlico Sound, the northern border counties known as the Virginia Piedmont, and the remaining central counties known as the North Carolina Piedmont. But ask Wolfram how many dialects there are in the state, and he'll respond anywhere from 2 to 200. Sitting in my office, we say Harker's Island and Ocracoke are the same dialect, he explains. But if you live on Harker's Island or Ocracoke, they're different dialects because the people know the differences. So when is it when is a dialect a dialect? In a sense, it's in the ears of the beholders, and that's why these designations are pretty fluid. Wolfram can tell often where in a state a person is from just by hearing them talk. In the coastal plain, you throw your luggage in the boot of the car, a term that is also heard in England, but developed independently here. In the western part of the state, folks go a-hunting and a-fishing, another holdover from Ireland and England, where people used to say they were at hunting or on fishing. The hoi-toi vowel pronunciation of the Outer Banks came down from the Chesapeake Bay area when many people migrated south by boat around the turn of the 18th century. In Appalachia, folks drink dope instead of soda, or as older generations in the state say, Coca-Cola. If something is crooked, they call it sigoglin. On the Outer Banks, something that's crooked is cattywampus or whopperjawed. If you don't have Tom to do something, you could be it from anywhere in the state. But if your ride is rain, Wolfram knows you're from either Appalachia or the coastal plain. Folks from the Piedmont usually speak using two vowels instead of one within a single syllable before a voiceless sound. Think five instead of five. Think five instead of five. Wolfram explains a voiceless sound this way. Put your hand on your throat and make a mmm sound and then an F sound. F. You'll feel that mmm sound causes your vocal cords to vibrate. The F sound f doesn't. That's a voiceless sound. In rural areas, parents carry their kids to the movies. Before bed, they cut off the lights. City folks take their kids to the movies and turn off the lights. People move to North Carolina cities from everywhere, and their dialects influence how people speak here. The chasm between urban and rural in North Carolina, Wolfram says, is greater than the difference between northern and southern speech at this point. Older folks mash buttons. Younger folks push them. In black dialects, the B form is common, I be going. While Lumbee Indians lost their ancestral language long ago, they speak a particular dialect of Southern English that identifies them as Lumbee. They're very proud of that, Wolfram says. Is there a universal North Carolina-ism that ties us all together? Why, yes. The double modal is stigmatized elsewhere, but not in the South. The last four governors of the state, Wolfram says, have used might could. Wie hast du geschlafen? Wolfram often says to his wife in the morning. How did you sleep? Ganz gut geschlafen, she responds. I slept quite well. After shunning German as a child, Wolfram now speaks the language often with his wife, who is also of German descent, and he does so with his mother tongue. Wolfram wants us to embrace our dialects. They unite us with other people of our own heritage. They are who we are, an Appalachian or a native of the Outer Banks, a baby boomer or a millennial, a country gal or a city guy. So forget your high school English class, and don't be ashamed of how you speak. However you're a-talkin', you're a talking right. And there's a little side piece of this article that's fun. The way we speak, Buddy Rowe. We North Carolinians have our own way of a talking. Here are a few words and phrases we use to communicate right. Dingbatter, a tourist on Ocracoke, comes from All in the Family with Archie Bunker. Halfback is a summer resident in the mountains. Buddy Rowe is a good friend from rural Piedmont. Over yonder means over there, mostly used in Appalachia. Yuns, plural of you in the Smoky Mountains. Arish, it's a cool breeze in the mountains and the coast. Poke, bag or paper bag from Appalachia and rural North Carolina. Pizer, porch on coastal plain in the Outer Banks. Fetch, to retrieve from rural North Carolina. Scud, a trip around the island by boat, car, or golf cart. That's from Ocracoke. Off, Use describe someone or something from outside the region. That's from Harker's Island and Ocracoke. Slam, completely, as in slam full or slam out. That's from rural Piedmont and Coastal Plain. I'm going to try one more article, and hopefully I don't have to cut it to fit the time. Where cleavers sing. In North Carolina, you don't just taste barbecue, you hear it, chopped by hand with a rhythm all its own. Cover my eyes with a blindfold, drive me to an unknown location, and I'd know immediately that I was in North Carolina if I heard just one sound, the steady thwacking, whack, whack, whack of a cleaver on a wooden cutting board as properly cooked pork is turned into a pile of barbecue. Nothing sounds exactly like it, and no other place, not Georgia, not Texas, not Kansas City, prepares its barbecue exactly this way. You can slice brisket and whack pork slabs into ribs. You can hack smoked chicken into the usual drums, wings, and thighs. But for pork barbecue, real pork barbecue, our pork, you have to chop it. You have to chop so much and so vigorously that you can gauge the authenticity of a barbecue joint just by looking at its cutting board. A good restaurant will have a trough carved right into the wood. The first time I went to Canterbury Cathedral in England, I was struck by the troughs worn into the stone steps by nearly 900 years of pilgrims climbing to the shrine to Thomas Becket, many on their knees. At a North Carolina barbecue joint, it doesn't take that long to wear out a board. From Red Bridges Barbecue Lodge in Shelby to Skylight Inn Barbecue in Aden, they chop so hard and so much that they wear through a board every 6 months. My job as a food editor at the Charlotte Observer, I once spent a glorious 24 hours hanging around the skylight. I listened to the murmur of people standing in line, waiting to pick up barbecue to take home. I heard the squeak of the foam plastic containers as Bruce Jones, the son of the lathe founder, Pete Jones, filled them with pork from the pile atop a massive wooden slab that was almost worn right through, topping each one with a shingle of cornbread. For me, the best part started behind the restaurant in the late afternoon as Bruce's brother, Jeff, shoveled glowing wood coals under whole hogs in the pits to start the next day's batch. I was still there at 10 o'clock at night while Jeff banked the fires, rattling down sheet metal covers on cables to cover the pigs. And I was back again at 5 o'clock in the morning when Jones walked over from his house across the highway. In a chattering wheelbarrow, he hauled loads of wood to tall brick fireplaces to stoke crackling fires. He shoveled more coals into the pits, the metal of the shovel blade raking across the concrete blocks with a twang. When the taut brown skins sounded like a drumhead when he tapped them with a knife, they were done. I'm going to have to make this shorter, I think. Over the din of the morning rush, I could hear it, the distinctive sound of chopping, a background drumming. Ramsey laughs when I stop by at lunchtime a few days later, eager to talk about chopping. Of course they still do it by hand, she says. My mama's motto was, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. Ramsey can't imagine not hand chopping because she's sure they get more meat off the pork shoulders doing it the old way, the right way. Sitting at Red Bridges, tucking into my plate of coarse chopped and with outside brown, I can hear the tap, tap, tap floating from the kitchen, and I know exactly where I'm supposed to be. Well, that sound says we were out of time for today's episode. I hope you enjoyed it, and you'll be sure to listen next time. I'm Martha Potter, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's reading of Our State Magazine is underwritten by Carter Glass Insurance Agency, serving the community since 1974. They can be reached at 919-781-1973. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired and is readily available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. For questions, call us at 919-832-5138.